The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I have the plague, but I feel better now that I'm here with all of you.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Many thanks to everybody listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. I was like, hey, folks, sign up, take the leap, join us in the camp of paying members, and several of you did. We skyrocketed to the top of the rising charts on the TV and film section of Substack. We were dominating, and I think we can do better, frankly. I think we can do a lot better, and I'm not saying that we should be beating the entertainment strategy guy who's like number three or four or whatever on like the overall pay, but we should be giving him a run. He should be sweating. He should be, when he's putting together his charts, he should be feeling our breath on his neck. More folks should sign up. We are so close. We're very close to sustainability after just 4 months. It's great. But I think we can get there before the half year mark, which would make everybody very happy. Anyway, on to
love seeing that number one on Rising. It's like winning the weekend for box office, right? Also made me feel like this must be what it feels like to be the U.S. hockey team after beating Canada.
It didn't feel anything.
Make sure
like
that we
at all,
have like
frankly.
A really impressive hold number into the next week. You can do it, you personally.
Anyway, so go sign up. It's fine. Anyway, on to controversies and non-controversies. Remember the Sony hack? When years worth of Sony emails were leaked and rummaged through by bottom feeders in the press like yours truly? Well, who can forget that, frankly? And who could forget about learning about the efforts to turn Peter Parker into a skateboarding EDM guy or whatever was going on over in Sony land? Anyway, do you remember why those emails were hacked and leaked? I feel like everyone has forgotten about this, but it was because of the North Koreans. It was an operation by the North Koreans who were furious at Sony Pictures for making a movie depicting the assassination of Kim Jong-un. That 2014 film, The Interview, which starred Seth Rogen and James Franco as a pair of guys tasked by the CIA with securing an interview with the dictator of North Korea and then assassinating him. Anyway, its release is a kind of a fascinating story in and of itself. Sony wound up losing support from theatrical partners who also did not want to get hacked, and they couldn't really secure a VOD release for it. Remember, this is before things would just go to streaming all the time. It was before VOD was a serious player in the market. Anyway, I mention all this because then CEO of Sony Pictures, Michael Lynton, has a new book out, in which he talks about his failures and his mistakes, well, the biggest of them being the events that led up to this hack. You know, it's one of these self-help business style books, I guess. I haven't read the whole thing. But he does have a long section in it where he's talking about the process that went into greenlighting The Interview. And this is in and of itself like kind of, it's an interesting business story, right? He writes about being wowed by the assembled star power during a table read and just being like, hey, let's do this thing instead of running the profitability numbers, running the traps, right, to that are supposed to slow down gut responses like that. But I was mostly interested in the fallout of the hack and the response to it. Here is how he put it in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. Quote, 8 months later, after it became clear that the North Koreans had hacked Sony and after the studio had lost its relationships with many of its most important stars, including Will Smith, Adam Sandler, and Angelina Jolie, I spoke to President Obama about the whole incident. Unsurprisingly, he asked the right question. What were you thinking when you made killing the leader of a hostile foreign nation a plot point? Of course, that was a mistake, end quote. In hindsight, Linton seems to agree with this assessment. And I want to say one thing in defense of Linton and Sony before addressing that. In the moment, they did the right thing. Threatened by a foreign power into curtailing their own speech and artistic output, Sony stuck to their guns and released the film, The Interview, without bolderizing it at the behest of a crazed dictator, right? They deserve some credit for that. They deserve some credit for that. Sony would do this a couple years later with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood comes out. Chinese are like, hey, you got to get rid of this Bruce Lee section because we find it offensive. And Quentin Tarantino tells them to pound sand. And Tom Rothman, who took over as head of Sony Pictures after the fallout from the hack, backed him, right? So, like, good for them. That's what a studio should do. They deserve some credit, certainly. And in this case, Linton talked to Matt Bellany on his podcast. And the thing he seemed most resentful about was that Seth Rogen didn't appreciate Sony backing them more. Frankly, I think, again, he's right to resent Rogen for that. Who came across not well during this whole thing. Anyway, that said, I do think it is insanely cowardly that the big takeaway from this event, from the president of the United States and the then head of a motion picture studio, is that filmmakers should not feel free to criticize or depict the death of even a foreign leader. Like, I'm sorry, if somebody had threatened the filmmakers of the 2006 mockumentary Death of a President, which is about the fictional assassination of George W. Bush, which took place during a very heated time in American political history, we'd all be up in arms. We would have been up in arms about it. Even I love George W. Bush, great president, would have voted for him a third time if I could have. You can't threaten a studio for making a movie like that, right? The Kingsman comes out and showed, albeit in somewhat coded visual language, Barack Obama's head exploding as the result of his being part of a massive deep state conspiracy, right? There should be no punishment for depicting this sort of thing. Artistic freedom must remain absolute for it to mean anything. Alyssa, did you get as annoyed by Obama and Linton as I did while reading that? Because I gotta be honest, I was terribly vexed.
I was very annoyed on a couple of levels. First, among other things, Obama really likes to sort of lean into his own self-created image as a patron of the arts, right? I mean, he is constantly releasing these best movie lists, these, you know, the best books he read, the best music he listened to in a year, all of which read as sort of incredibly curated and surprising. Also, I'm sorry, the man is in the movie business now. Right? Like, he, Higher Ground Productions, makes documentaries and movies. And if he has not developed some appreciation for, you know, the importance of artistic freedom there, that makes me think a lot less of him. The second sort of aspect to this is that, yes, The Interview is depicting the assassination of a foreign leader, but it's also making fun of the CIA, right? And I think there is real, you know, you want to stake out a position that you can make fun of the actions of your own government, especially as it relates to adventurism overseas, right? I mean, the United States has a long, somewhat ignoble history of this. And it's not just a question of, are you allowed to poke the North Koreans and is poking the North Koreans a smart thing to do? But can you poke fun at your own government, right? I actually think that's sort of quite important aspect of this to look back on. The second thing that I found sort of cowardly and weird about this is that, you know, Linton frames this decision as him just wanting to be one of the cool guys. And, you know, maybe the excerpt in the Wall Street Journal sort of doesn't include more analysis of this. But certainly what I came away from that piece thinking was, like, he saw this, he thought it killed in the room. And so did he greenlight it because he thought it was funny or because he wanted, like, Amy Pascal, who he describes as, like, much cooler than him to like him, right? And I don't know, there's something just very strange about the depiction, about his self-presentation here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is the movie, maybe he didn't assess the risk appropriately, but like, did he think it was funny or not? Did he think it was going to be a good movie or not, right? That it's weirdly sort of sidestepped in his depiction of his own reaction and decision-making here. And like, yes, I think assessing the risks totally makes sense, but also like, if he thought it was going to kill, like, that seems important, right? That doesn't actually seem like he's having a sort of reaction to the cool girls in the room. It also weirdly seems to, like,
I sort of got the impression that it was kind of, I got the impression it was somewhere in between, that he both thought it was quite funny, but also that he was sort of overwhelmed by the response in the room, which is not this quite the same thing as thinking it's very funny yourself. Like, he didn't find it unfunny or flat or something like that. I think the impression I got was he enjoyed it, but the room was great. And also he was bowled over by both the reaction and the star power, all of whom, of course, were part of the were going to get paid if this got made and wanted to get it made. And so what he then didn't do was then sort of think about more normie viewers who it is his job to think about. I agree. It's a weird way to present. Like, he sort of comes in and positions himself as the stilted, awkward suit who doesn't understand these creatives. At the same time, he's also running a freaking movie studio. He should understand movies.
And starts
by talking about how he loved movies from the time he was a kid, and is like, he thinks of himself as a film lover and a cinephile to some degree.
Right. And so I think this is what bugs me, right? Like, either you're the powerful person in the room, like you're running the studio, or you're not. And I'm sorry if you are so sort of bowled over, not just by like Seth Rogen and James Franco, but by your own colleagues, like, doesn't that kind of say more about, I mean, I think the point of the piece is sort of that it says more about you, but like, there's a weird tone of sort of victimization here, right? It's like, oh, I'm the poor rube who just like wanted these guys to think I was cool. Like, you have the power, man. You have the checkbook. Like, nobody, like, okay, yes, yeah, you're wearing the suit, but like, you're also the boss. And if you don't realize that, you know.
There's definitely an element of this op-ed, as you say, Alyssa, that comes across as frankly just kind of whiny. And like, I feel bad saying this because I think the point of the piece is to be like, hey, I had a personal blind spot, and my flaw here, my desire to be accepted as part of the in crowd, is what led me to do this. And like, one of the reasons so many of these books are boring is because people take the safe routes out, and they say the safe things, and they just like, oh, we thought it would work, or we didn't. And I do think that there's an element of honesty here that, admirable is the wrong word, but I've like, it's honest and good for him. But man, at the same time, I was just like, that is weirdly pathetic. What I'm hearing here. It was weird to read.
There was definitely an aspect of like, this might be something that you deal with in your therapist's office rather than offering it as business advice. I mean, the other thing I would say,
well,
is,
that's what books are. That's what business memoirs are, therapy, except hopefully you come out making money rather than paying.
Yes. But I will also just say, and I mean, you know, I have not had a ton of experience interviewing really big name stars, but during my time at Think Progress and the Washington Post, I found that the vast majority of people I interviewed, and I'm including people like Claire Danes, Carrie Russell, Matthew Rice, were sort of shockingly polite to me, even as sort of a small timer. And, you know, maybe Rogan and Franco, maybe at that time it was a different dynamic, but it is sort of hard. I mean, and they were trying to get money out of him, right? Like, it's sort of hard for me to think that they would have been like really intentionally sort of off-putting or trying to make him feel bad. Like it really just feels like something that's very in his head. And maybe the message of the book is like, if you're going to make big decisions with important people, you can't be super in your head about your relative social status. You need to be realistic about, you know, your power in the room. And that's the kind of advice that you, I think, more often hear women executives giving to other women in business books, which is probably a reason it feels kind of weird to hear it from a guy. But it just, it is the kind of thing that people sometimes publish that just does not come across the way I think they mean it to come across. But also Barack Obama comes across as terribly in this. And like,
what Obama does is he treats a major motion picture as an act of like tactical international relations and messaging. And that's not what a movie is. That's an appropriate response if you're talking to a diplomat or a White House comms person. If that's what you're doing and that's what you, but that's, Obama can't see the difference between the two. And frankly, you know, in the Obama era, we saw so much sort of collision between Hollywood and politics. And I mean, in some ways that sort of continued, obviously, in very different and deranged kind of ways. But like these things have to stay separate to some degree. And I fear that for the last 15 or 20 years, people on both sides of the country, both coasts, the power coasts and right, the political power coast and the cultural power coast, I kind of haven't understood that these are in fact separate and different things, and they're different jobs.
And if you're Obama, I would not scream the interview at the White House, but I also would say, one of the differences between the United States and North Korea is like, we will release in our theaters a movie that basically depicts my head getting blown up. Because you know what? We can take it. We have, you know, we are a confident liberal democracy and we are not a bunch of, you know, we're not a bunch of crazy authoritarians. Anyway, just terrible.
We all know that if there was the equivalent of a meaningful movie studio in Europe or, you know, France or the UK or something or Canada right now, and they made a movie that made Trump mad, that he would retaliate. I mean, we wouldn't hack this, like, it wouldn't be that 100%. The CIA hacks the studio, but like, there would certainly be grouchiness. I mean, God, Lord knows whether that it would actually
be
tariffs.
There would be 900% tariffs on that country.
Well, this is, I mean, one of the, I'm now forgetting which one of the tariffs that was like, that he installed before the Supreme Court said that his existing method of applying tariffs was illegal, but was just, he literally said that, like, this was because I'm mad at them. Like, he was a personal pick, right? And this, you know, it's unfortunate. Like, how many Hollywood leaders would say it's appropriate to then, that's just a part of doing business and you got to kowtow to people like that? Maybe some of them would at this point. Lord knows. Bad scene.
No, this is America. We don't try to make ourselves deliberately disagreeable, to quote the president, just because we're
peaked. Let me ask. I'm totally on board with you got to be able to make movies where, especially comedies that are farcical, that are intended not, you know, as sort of to rally people to violence, anything, right? Like, it's just obviously intended to be absurd, with maybe some sort of political point. You have to be able to do that. I'm totally on board. So let me start there. Let me ask Sonny in particular, but both of you, a question. Just as a business leader, this guy's running a company with billions of dollars in revenue. If he understood or believed in the moment that making this movie was going to cause his company to lose a huge amount of money, totally change the reputation of the company, right? Just like be a massive business catastrophe, that hack was a huge, huge problem. Is there a kind of a case for timidity here? I don't mean an artistic case. I don't mean a moral case. I don't mean a free speech case or a political case. I mean being a good steward of your business, because it's not just you and it's not just art that you're defending. You're also defending a lot of people's jobs. There's just a lot of people who are just middle class people who work for you. And if your company has this sort of problems that happened after this hack, your job is to make sure that doesn't happen.
I'm not sure I understand the question beyond, like, in hindsight being 2020, would you have still made this movie? And, like, I don't know. I mean, I, like, the if you believe in the movie, if you believe it's funny, then yes, you still make it and you release it. Part of the problem here, I mean, it's funny. The reason that they pick North Korea is not just because Kim Jong-un is a crazy dictator, like lots of places have crazy dictators. It's because North Korea for a bunch of years was the acceptable punching bag when you didn't want to attack China, right? Like, this is what happened with the Red Dawn remake. They, you know, redid it all over to make it, you know, this ridiculous notion that North Korea could invade the west coast of the United States.
And it wasn't, like, even like not really North Korea. It was like a splinter group from North Korea or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm thinking of the, like, first White House.
That might be
Olympus has fallen or something.
All of this could have been avoided if they just did it with, you know, if they did what Hollywood always does, which is to invent a country and then make that the target of the thing. And, like, I guess you could do that. You could do that. You could get away with it. It'd be fine. But, like, I don't know. I find that that's cowardly and annoying in its own way. And frankly, I find that takes me out of the movie as much as, like, you know, they have this whole system for, you know, trying to create realism and verisimilitude in these things. And when it's like the Republic of Jirakistan, like, oh, okay, well,
this is exactly what they did in last summer's. This is what they did in last summer's Superman.
Yep.
Exactly.
Clearly what needs to happen is for Sony to make a romantic comedy about the problems of, like, the first, you know, girl power lady dictator of North Korea. And, like, how she's great and has, you know, beaten the United States to female leadership. And then all will be forgiven.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it controversy or a non-troversy that the president of the United States and the one-time CEO of Sony Pictures believe that the lesson of the Sony hack is don't be so mean to dictators? Alyssa?
It's controversy.
Peter?
Controversy.
Yeah, it's controversy. That's right. Controversy. All right. Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for our bonus episode on the finale of A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. A fun season of Game of Thrones. Is the show back on the right track? I don't know. We'll discuss.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And now on to the main event. Good luck. Have Fun, Don't Die, starring Sam Rockwell as a time traveler who looks suspiciously like a bum ranting about cell phones. Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die is the first film from Gore Verbinski, who made The Ring, Rango, first few Pirates of the Caribbean films, among others, in nearly a decade. The film is really an anthology about modern Technology and its impact on life, from cell phone addiction to the way tech tries to paper over loss and grief to the rise of AI and its ability to give people an escape from the drudgery of reality, all of which is kind of structured around Rockwell's character's efforts to stop the rise of a super intelligent artificial intelligence that has destroyed humanity in his own time. It kicks off with a 10-minute monologue about the way everyone kind of has their face constantly stuck in their phone, ignoring each other in a Norm's diner, while he kind of hops from table to table in this Norm's diner, ranting about the insanity of it all, before he assembles a team he hopes will stop what's coming. Intercut with this mission are vignettes that show what his team was up to before they got there. Michael Pena and Zazie Beetz were teachers at a high school where the kids are addicted to an Instagram-like app that just shows a constant stream of hypnotic videos. Juno Temple plays a mom whose son dies in a school shooting only to be resurrected as a robotic clone who occasionally spouts ad slogans, while Haley Lou Richardson plays a woman who is allergic to cell phones and Wi-Fi, a kind of tough handicap in modern society. Now, one of the nice things about this movie is that it looks like a real movie where people like have spent time thinking about the visual cues for each moment. Just one small, for instance, in the early going, we begin the film with a camera that kind of pans down the side of this cafe, which again, it's called Norm's, which is a chain in California. And then it cuts from inside the cafe, or then it cuts inside to the cafe after scanning down this word, Norm's, where we see the people, all the people who are just ignoring each other while they stare into their phones, engaging in the endless scroll, ignoring each other. We have developed these new norms. We have developed new norms, norms in norms, and they're all grotesque. They're antisocial norms. They're anti-human norms in a very real way. This is a strange movie. Look, I found it pleasingly goofy as a big fan of Terry Gilliam, the Monty Python alum who made, Brazil, Time Bandits, 12 Monkeys, other films. There is a lot to love here, but it's definitely a movie you have to buy into. You have to accept its unreality if you're gonna get into it and enjoy it. I interviewed the writer of this film, Matthew Robinson. I try to avoid reviewing things by people I've interviewed to avoid conflict of interest problems. I have some modest critiques of this film. The last 45 minutes drag a little bit. There's probably 10 or 15 minutes that maybe could have been trimmed. I think they could have skipped that big CGI sequence at the end of the film. I don't want to spoil anything. But the quibbles I have should not dissuade people from going to see it. I liked it. If I were to give this movie a thumbs up or a thumbs down, it would be a thumbs up. But I don't think I'm allowed to. Anyway, Peter, what did you make of Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die?
Unfortunately, I didn't love this movie. I was really hoping to like it. I like a lot of what Gore Verbinski has done. Sam Rockwell, I always think, is sort of underrated, and he is almost like, he's definitely the best part of this movie. But I had kind of two tracks of frustration with this. One is, apart from Sam Rockwell, I just didn't connect with any of these characters. They didn't really seem like they existed in a psychological or emotional space that made any kind of sense to me, right? I kept waiting for some reveal that, in fact, the world we were looking at, that was the real world that needed to be saved, was not the real world. It was some sort of simulation, and that's why everyone was acting so stilted and strange and not really responding to things in the way that you would expect them to respond to. And it's just, and like, they're kind of commenting on this at times. I mean, especially the Michael Pena character is sort of like, why do you keep saying Pepsi, right? Like, why is there, like, and so you have this other, right, and that's explained in the sense that these kids have been programmed to be kind of ad bot humans. But his own character doesn't seem in some ways sufficiently grounded in any kind of real world or real psychology to care or connect. And I think that's true, frankly, of basically every character in this film, with, like I said, the exception of Sam Rockwell, who doesn't seem like a real person in any way, but is just so charmingly quirky that it kind of overcomes a lot of this. And then the other thing is, this movie's critique of technology did not land for me. And yes, I'm the pro AI guy on this podcast, and I'm probably more sort of sympathetic to, like, in fact, there's good things about this. Though one reason why it didn't work for me is this movie doesn't really kind of wrestle
with I think the real issues, or sort of like the trade-offs, like the ups and the downs of technology use. It just sort of presents everything as straightforwardly like, well, this is inhuman and deadening and it's robbing us of our humanity. And it does so in a way that is, it's not quite smug. And I appreciated that. It's not too pleased with itself, but it doesn't really offer inside, right? Was that a Tom Stoppard quote that went around after when he passed, right? He said something to the effect, people were asking about him about whether he was political. And he was like, well, you know, obviously later in his life, he became somewhat more so, even called himself a libertarian at times. But early on, he was sort of perceived as just being a guy who was into wordplay and who wasn't engaging with politics, unlike a lot of his playwright contemporaries. And what he said was, well, I write so I can argue with myself. I write so I can contradict myself. And that's part of what's wonderful about his work is you see ideas being batted back and forth by people, sometimes by two different characters who hold totally different worldviews, sometimes by a single character who can't decide or who's sort of is torn. And in some ways that makes, you know, that makes some of the arguments that come, you know, sort of the stuff that comes later in his career more powerful, because you see inside the film, inside the story, that multiple ideas can be, right? These movies in some sense, or his plays, pass the ideological Turing test. And this movie just doesn't even bother to try. There's no point at which it sort of gives you an argument between someone who thinks maybe, well, I'd like to be on my phone all day because it connects me to my kids and it, or whatever it is, even if you like, there's nothing like that. And so as a message movie, it certainly, I've seen movies that are more annoying and that are more smug and more self-satisfied. And I give this movie credit for presenting its main message in the character of someone who is inherently somewhat suspect and unreliable, the Sam Rockwell character. And that goes a long way towards like making me kind of accept this and finding some of that stuff charming. But this movie just doesn't do nearly enough to argue with itself inside the text. It doesn't, and then you have characters who I don't care about, who I find kind of flat and unrealistic. Flat characters and a very simplistic viewpoint that like doesn't really do anything with its ideas just didn't work for me. It has some nice visual ideas. And maybe that's the third thing the related second thing is it's pretty weird to see this from Gore Verbinski, who has been an innovator in cinema throughout his career, in particular, the second and third Pirates of the Caribbean films were just, I mean, they were incredibly expensive. The third one was at the time maybe the most expensive studio film ever produced, at least on an inflation not adjusted basis. And the effects work in those films, like he was a guy who really understood that computers were going to make it possible to show you things that you'd never seen before on screen, and go back and watch those films, even if they're kind of messy and weird, but they are also absolutely incredible displays of CGI. They look better than a lot of the CGI we've seen over the last 5 or 10 years, even though those movies are 20 years old. So it's pretty weird to have an anti-tech message coming from somebody who built his career on technology.
Yeah, it's almost like he sees what's happening now and realizes it's bad and not like the things that have happened before. Alyssa, I'm not surprised that Peter isn't into this because he's in the pocket of big AI. But I'm curious what you made of Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die.
I think I probably fall somewhere in between the two of you in that I think Rockwell is enormously fun to watch in this movie. I don't think the actual sort of scaffolding of the quest works terribly well. Like those were the parts of the movies that I thought sort of dragged the most. But I did find the sort of short stories in this movie interesting, in part because they made me think about and think back to Don't Worry, Darling, actually, and the question of why people would choose to plug in to systems like these. And Peter, I can see why maybe I can't quite see why you found that kind of counter argument flat. But I actually think that I like Juno Temple as an actress a lot. I think her story, where you see someone who kind of grabs at a new technology in a moment of just sort of extreme grief and unsettlement, and comes to regret it, right? Or comes to regret a version of it. You know, the tech company that clones her son sort of takes advantage of her, and the influencers who push her to adopt this technology take advantage of her at a moment when she is incredibly vulnerable, has not even really processed that her son is dead. And she becomes sort of addicted to a version of it, right? She is grieving so deeply and misses her son so much that even the sort of simulacra of him, she will follow anywhere. And I did find that interesting and compelling. I think despite the fact that Haley Lou Richardson is sort of is a nice actress, the segment where, you know, she has like found this anti-tech boyfriend who suddenly becomes interested in this headset and who decides to sort of enter the world full time, like, that was the one that felt like it both had a lot of potential and was just very incomplete in terms of providing an explanation for like why he got curious about this or why he decided that the sort of the tech utopia that he had, was entering himself into was superior to, you know, to the real world that he once embraced. And I do think that this is a really, you know, this is, in to my mind, a very interesting question of this moment, right? And this is one of the big political questions, which is, you know, why would people choose the simulacra over reality, right? Like, why would you make a bot of your dead son as opposed to experiencing authentic grief? Why would you, you know, vanish into your goon cave or your online casino instead of pursuing a relationship with an actual woman or figuring out your place in the new economy, right? Like, how do we get to a place where reality seems so unappealing to so many people, and where technology is producing, you know, the ability to sort of live in these opium dens? And what do we do? What do those of us who still believe in touching grass and living in the real world and having relationships and kids and families, like, how do we make the case for that again? Right. And I do think, you know, I don't think Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die works as well as it could on, you know, the argument that I think it wants to make. But I do think that it is at times just quite engaging and propulsive. And if it sort of fails at the end, I think it's because that sort of central big adventure doesn't quite hold together. And I think Peter's right that the counter arguments sort of aren't quite strong enough.
I'll say one thing that's kind of interesting about the movie is that it basically posits, particularly in that third segment that we're talking about here, where this woman who is allergic to Wi-Fi and cell phones finds a boyfriend who also hates technology, and then one day he is gifted a headset that, you know, basically, you know, what are they called?
It looks like a virtual reality.
Like an Oculus.
It looks like a virtual reality headset of some sort. Though we never see what he sees at all.
Yeah.
Which is a problem. Why is he enticed?
Right, but it's so compelling. It's so compelling he chooses that life. Like it basically posits a question of like, what if you wanted to plug into the Matrix, right? That's the actual thing that this movie is doing in that segment is trying to do. And I think that that's kind of interesting. I don't know that you actually need to see what heaven looks like for it to necessarily to work as kind of a counter critique. I think as long as you accept that what he is seeing is real to him, and I don't think we have any reason not to, that it doesn't work. What the quest part of it not being compelling to you guys is interesting to me, because it's very explicitly structured like a video game. It is, and this is one of the real ideas in the film, kind of a second order idea, is, well, pretty obviously Sam Rockwell is actually already in this virtual reality. He thinks he's trying to prevent it from happening, but he's already there and he's not escaping. And he's in the world that the machine has created for him is like a video game adventure quest that he's going to keep looping back and doing over and over and over again. He's going back to the start. He's going back to his save point. It's a rogue. What do they call it? A roguelike is what this is.
It's roguelike because it's different each time. So it's the sort of same bit. You start from the same point and then the game auto generates new rooms or challenges or whatever. Yeah.
And that's what's obviously happening. He is already in the Matrix. He has already been sucked in, and he is now living a life where he is trying to escape from it, which I think is kind of interesting. And I think, to the credit of the film, doesn't hammer on that. It lets you kind of pull that thread on your own if you're thinking about it.
But if that's the case, then all the people who are in that world interacting with him, all of our other characters, are they living in that too? Are they part of the movie because the movie is expecting
then why do we
us
care?
To connect with them on a human level, and is what the movie is saying that everything
why do we care about characters
see,
in a video game? Characters in a video game aren't real. I care about what happens to the little creepy girls in BioShock. That's why I choose to save them, not kill them.
Well, sometimes I care about them, and sometimes I don't, because the game presents them as so sort of weightless that, like, it's amusing to just play with them as if they don't have souls, because they don't, because they're not people. And, like, that's actually one of the core, many video games allow you to basically play on evil mode, where you treat everyone and everything sort of with maximum hostility and awfulness, because there's nothing wrong with playing a video game on evil mode, because it's a video game. You're not being mean or awful to a person.
I would not enjoy that. My favorite video games have a
great stealing mechanism, and one of the things I love in those games is to steal everything and, like, work your way through the world backwards and forwards, just pull it, like pickpocketing and stealing stuff from every single store, from every single king or, like, you know, faction or whatever, right? And it's great fun. It's part of the enjoyment of the game. And you also, I mean, in all of these games, even if you're playing as a sort of moderately moral person, you're often killing dozens, if not hundreds, of people. You can't really treat it like the real world. And so this is why I ask, are we supposed to understand those other people as existing in a real world that has some sort of moral weight or not?
Again, I don't think it actually matters that much. But also because this is, like, kind of a cartoony Gilliam-esque satire. Like, this is not The Godfather. I don't think we're, you know...
I agree with that, but in its satire, that's part of why the emotional stuff with, say, the woman who loses her son doesn't land, is because it doesn't know how to treat that stuff with any weight. And it's possible, yes, I think, for satires to manage to sort of balance between these two things. But think about the way that woman's the revelation is that she loses her son in a school shooting, and when we first encounter the school shooting, it's through Michael Peña's character, who is a substitute teacher in the school and just having a weird, awkward day. And then he gets chased by zombie kids. And then it's like, wait, oh, there's a school shooting. And they end up in a little weird safe room that makes no sense. I asked Alyssa, actually, while we were watching this movie, do schools have these green light safe rooms now where everybody just sort of retires? And nobody, by the way, in that scene when they've retired to the school shooting safe room reacts with anything like the kind of real panic, the terror that you would have if you were in a mass shooting environment. They're just sort of like, we're back up. Let's go back to class now.
The whole point of all of those sequences is that they're so banal that people don't react to them with terror. And they end up losing not just their children, but the clones of the children. And so they start bringing the children back as, like, goofy other things. Like, it's the whole point is the absurdity. The whole point is numbing people to the reality by emphasizing the absurdity of it.
This movie left me numb. Which I think was not the effect it intended.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die? Peter?
Sadly, thumbs down. I did think that it's got some very clever visual ideas. Gore Verbinski is just on a craft level accomplished director. And Sam Rockwell's great.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up, but with caveats.
All right. And again, no rating from me. I'm above it all. I'm above the fray here. That's what I do. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. Want to bring a little Hollywood excitement to your day? Take a few spins with Chumba Casino's brand new game, Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways. It's free and features 10,000 ways to play, giving you nonstop action, including thrilling bonus respins and cascading reels. Every spin brings something new, so step into the spotlight, enjoy the excitement, and play today at chumbacasino.com.
Ch-ch-ch-ch-chumba. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.